There is a bit of explicit content in the podcast you are about to hear. It's Friday, March 22nd, 2019. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. The Mueller report is in. We don't have details yet. But you should also know, as that happened, ISIS is out. Yes, ISIS is defeated. Woohoo! Have you heard? The caliphate is past its caliph sell-by date. The Islamic State in Syria is in Syria no more. The White House says, in tweets with caps, that ISIS is 100% defeated. Here's Fox News coverage.
For the first time since we've been here in Syria, 5 days covering this offensive, the bombs have stopped dropping. The gunfire has disappeared. There's an eerie calm here now, and I think we have witnessed the end of the caliphate.
Now, maybe those words would be more convincing if the reporter weren't covered in full body armor and a helmet. Maybe he's just worried about being radicalized online. CBS also reported on the facts of ISIS being defeated, which is true in terms of a caliphate that claims territory, actively fighting. But then the reporter added this.
Now, the defeat of ISIS on the ground is a major milestone, but tens of thousands of ISIS members and supporters have melted away, and they will continue to pose a threat to the security of this region.
The White House should know that much like declaring infrastructure weak doesn't make it so, crowing about the defeat of ISIS has a huge potential to come back and bite you in the rear or bomb you in the marketplace. Some strain of virulent anti-Western terrorism will rise. In fact, doesn't need to rise. It's there and always has been there. It hasn't stopped targeting innocents, often those allied with the United States. Take that into account when you consider the argument put forth by President Trump today as he talked to reporters with his helicopter whirling in the background.
I brought this out for you because this is a map of everything in the red. This was on election night in 2016. Everything red is ISIS. When I took it over, it was a mess. Now, on the bottom, that's the exact same. There is no red.
There are streets that are running pretty red, Mr. President, still, right now. 2 months ago, a massive car bomb in Afghanistan killed dozens of people, could have been over 100. Boko Haram killed 23 people in Chad yesterday. The day before that, ISIS, yes, the ISIS that you say is defeated, killed 5 in Syria and 6 in Afghanistan. That was a bombing that injured another 23. There is very little good that could come from bragging that you defeated an enemy if that enemy continues to kill the day before your triumphant tweet, and I'm sure within the days to come. It is short-sighted and misleading. But hey, it's fun to say. We beat ISIS. Oh, those bombings? Oh, those executions? Oh, those beheadings? Never mind that. Pay attention to these tweets with these exclamations and this map. On the show today, I spiel about the real upsets of March Madness. They might not be what you think, but they also are kind of a little bit what you think. But first, onto one of the truly gifted novelists working today, John Lanchester, always comes up with something exciting and new, and his new book, The Wall, is just that. The setting is England, or an England-y type place, a little less landmass than it has now because it's a book set in the future, and global warming has hit and hit hard. And now, life in England is about keeping out the refugees and tamping down unrest from within. How to do it? Well, I can think of one solution that always works, The Wall, which is the name of the novel. John Lanchester, up next. The Defender is a beautiful car, but beauty is, of course, sometimes only skin deep. Not with the Defender. Let's talk about the interior. It's robust, built with integrity. Yes, it's designed iconically, the exterior. That's what compelled me. My neighbor Jay says, Mike, you see what's on the block? It's a Defender. And I look down the block, and indeed there is. And me and Jay, the neighbor, and Michelle, we gather around the Defender. We peer in the window. I have to say, I don't want to make this a little too tawdry, but we lust, or perhaps we gvel. To drive the Defender is to explore with greater confidence. We looked at the cargo capacity, more room for the gear. There's really a wide range of adventures the Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. Push what's possible with a vehicle made to go further, the Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender. The Wall is a new novel from John Lanchester. His previous books, The Debt to Pleasure and Capital, if you read them, give you a clue that this is a man with a journalism background. He likes to take a story, or although you get the sense with The Wall, he was almost forced to take a story that's in the news and play it out in a slightly different way, either traipsing through time or from a different milieu. The Wall is about a United Kingdom in the future where the sea has risen and the immigrants have been pushed out. We follow the story of Kavanaugh, a man who is assigned to the wall, and everything that happens to him afterwards. John Lanchester, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
What am I right? Was this the sort of story that you just couldn't get the idea of it out of your head? You were compelled to grapple with it in the form of fiction, what was going on in the world around you with Brexit and anti-immigration sentiment?
I'm trying to think of a polite way of saying no.
It was the other
way around. No, I was writing a novel about something else. Still am, actually. I was part of the way through a book. And I began having a recurring dream. And it was a dream that had this image of a man standing on a wall alone at night in the dark and the cold with the water on the other side. And I eventually started thinking, well, what's that about? And realized, my first question was, who is he? And then realized, actually, I was asking the wrong question. The question was about, what world is that?
Right.
And realized that it was a world after catastrophic climate change. So the odd thing was that this was sort of early 2016. So Brexit and Trump and all that were happening in the background. But and I did know that I was writing about climate change. That was very much in the forefront of my head, and I was aware of it. But the kind of weird coincidences about, walls suddenly being all over the news and things like that. I mean, at that point, I would have gone out and bet the value of my house against Trump being the Republican nominee, let alone the president, let alone, having his fantasies about building a wall. It's strange what leaks into a book.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly, it can't be just a billion to one coincidence. Clearly those things, their fingerprints are in the book, but they weren't what was in the forefront of my mind.
Yes. In fact, when I was reading the book, I wasn't so much thinking about the wall that Trump keeps prattling on about, because that wall doesn't exist. I was thinking more about the idea of being insular and making America and England into fortresses, Fortress America, and how impractical an idea that is. And yet, if it were an idea, what would it look like? So, yes, when I never thought about the wall on the southern border. I thought more about walls along our shores, all of our shores, to keep outsiders and, as you call it, the others out.
Definitely. I mean, I did think in terms of, sort of projecting two things forward into the future that are trends in the present. It's a bit like the thing where you get on a graph, an economic graph, you get a solid line going up to the present moment, and then dotted lines projected into the future. And I was thinking about two kinds of dotted line. One about trends in climate. If we have unchecked emissions and the darker scenarios that the scientists are coming up are true. That was one of the trend lines. And the other one was the trend in our society and politics. And I think it does look, if we kind of step back, and try, which is admittedly very difficult to do, but if we looked at the present moment from a kind of historical perspective, I think it would seem really apparent that we've moved from an epoch of walls coming down, borders opening, kind of globalized and international perspectives, to a time when we are wanting to turn inwards, look in towards ourselves, to, close the borders, pull up the drawbridge, to say, we have nothing in common with those people who are fleeing desperately to come to our countries. I think, and there's this odd thing that in terms of walls and borders, most of all the walls built since the Second World War were built this century. We are living in a great era of fortifications going up, and Trump's wall is in the papers, but there's a wall between India and Pakistan. There's a wall between Israel and the Palestinian state. Iraq is walled off on every side. There's a huge wall in the Sahara Desert between Western Sahara and the rest. There are walls, shiny new high-tech walls and borders are going up even as we speak. And I think there is a kind of one of those strange inexplicable things, a kind of global shift of mood. And I think we are moving towards a period where people are, looking inward.
Yeah. And I wonder if you had a count of all the gated communities. Those are walls that are affecting all of our lives, and they definitely have risen in the last 20 years as opposed to the 50 after World War II.
And I think there's a thing about every, I think there's a paradoxical thing about walls, that every wall that was ever built, anywhere in the world was built to make somebody feel more secure.
Mm-hmm.
That's the basic impulse, that, you know, people feel safer if they have a wall around them. And yet at the same time, they have a tremendous, their intention is to exclude. And a wall looks very different when you're on the other side of it. And I'm really interested in that doubleness. They create an us and a them. And when people talk about the Great Wall of China, if you go and look at it on a map, you think, well, actually, they should have called that the slightly below average Wall of China, because it doesn't actually go around, you know, the kind of a bit rubbish Wall of China, you know. Not only can you not see it from space, it's kind of beta minus. But actually, you know, historians make the point that it's actually about defining Chinese-ness as much as it's an actual fortification. It's about, you know, the Han Chinese are on one side, and on the other side, it's the barbarians.
Yes.
You know, they're kind of covering themselves in bear fat and getting up to who knows what. And I think that's one of the crucial things that walls do. They're about security and also about this sense of otherness and division.
And they also are always built to keep the others out, but of course they then keep the community in. And at least in America, that's, I think, what was going on, whether the people who were most in favor of it knew it or not. It's like, well, if we build this wall, the Mexicans won't be there. But guess what? Guess who will be here? The real people who should be here.
Yes. And I think that sense of the kind of internal consequences of what walls do is very important. I think it's one of the reasons, I don't like coming to America and telling Americans about their politics. I think it's a bit impersonal.
Well, I'll tell you a little bit about Brexit and what they just voted on, sheep tariffs. I cannot believe.
Exactly. We'll swap. but there is certainly that sense of defining an us and a them and an inclusion and an exclusion. That's very, you know, that's the sort of central theme in the way that in the kind of imaginary resonances of walls. And yet you have this other thing at the same time that if you talk to Germans who are alive in the era of the Cold War and the Iron Curtain and the Berlin Wall, you know, the Berlin Wall ran through the heart of every German. Every German felt their country was divided, and you know, the place you were from had all kinds of particular meaning to do with which side of it you were on, you know, and where what your identity was and all that. And at the same time, it wasn't a metaphor.
Yeah.
You know, it was a very powerful organizing metaphor, and yet also a brutal physical fact that got people killed every day trying to cross it. And you have that strange thing about Trump's wall too, that it's, on one hand, it's this sort of imaginary thing about who we are and the kind of usness of us. And at the same time, it would be this actual oppressive physical reality. I think that's, you know, there are all these dualities around the subject of walls. I think that's one really important one.
How often do you pay attention to dreams?
Well, not very. And that's why it was a bit odd. I've written one or two short things that came out like that, but not often. I think there's a thing, I don't in general subscribe to a Freudian view that our dreams are saturated with meaning all the time, but I think it's it's one of the African cultures, one of the tribal cultures, I don't remember which, but they make a distinction between the great dreams and lesser dreams.
Yeah.
You know, that as when, you know, so the dream you have where you're angry with your mother-in-law, you know, that's not a big deal. But, you know, occasionally you have a dream that actually has consequences. And that's happened to me one or two times. So I do basically sign up to that sometimes, you know, most of the time it's just rubbish, but occasionally something does force itself on you.
Like the Greeks with all their definitions of love, I think the pre-industrial cultures have a lot of different ways of thinking of dreams and sleep that we don't anymore. Of course, it was their great entertainment.
Well, I also think we overvalue, you know, I'm very interested in Neolithic cultures and old versions of humanity before we were, you know, the person we are now with our cultures based on writing and all that. And I think that we, you know, this thing called the Flynn effect, which is the thing about our IQ going up.
Yeah.
Which is slightly mysterious. And I think it's partly because our whole lives are skewed around things that make us good at IQ tests, about pattern recognition, processing information, recognizing similarities, retaining certain sorts of information. And I think we used to live in a way that actually prioritized other parts of our brain, and you know, dreams, reveries, fantasies, altered states, trance-like states, visions, things like that. I think those used to be a much more important part of what it meant to be human. I think we are these weird, I remember the Australian tennis great Rod Laver, who was 5'8" tall, but his left arm, his bicep was the same circumference as Muhammad Ali, because he was a left-handed tennis player, and that's how hard he hit it. And we're a little bit like, we're kind of Rod Lavers with one part of our brain, and we have these other parts we don't use, which we occasionally put to work.
I think it's Steven Pinker, but one of those guys speculates that it's because of more abstract thought. As we got wealthier and were forced to and got to, there was a good reason to engage in abstract thought that would allow our intelligence to expand, or at least intelligence as measured on the IQ test. But that actually doesn't contradict what you're saying at all.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense, doesn't it? And it's one of the things, you know, if you're thinking in terms of prehistory, you know, we're kind of living at in the same place and at the same time as Neanderthals for about, you know, for I think something like 50,000 years. And, you know, then somehow we outcompete them and we win. And it does overlap with the period of the last really significant change in the climate. And it would figure that, you know, since we know the Neanderthals weren't dumb and were in Western Europe for millennia, that you had something that we could do that they couldn't. And maybe it was a thing like, you know, they were capable of making tools, hunting, making fun, things like that, but they weren't capable of framing a thought like the climate is changing. You know, that's a level of abstraction and thing that, you know, we could manage and they couldn't.
Yes. Yes, they just didn't have the means to understand their reality in that way. And I don't know, maybe we don't have the means to understand if when you're talking about trance-like and dreamlike thoughts, maybe that will somehow come to bite our species in the ass. I don't know.
Or it's possible if you imagine, you know, someone looking back at us living through a moment where as with our last chance to avert catastrophic climate change. And if we let it go, it might seem very obvious that we have a cognitive defect, that, you know, our ability to project imagination into the future, to react to the needs, because in a sense, what we're saying we have to act now, we're reacting to the needs of people who haven't been born yet.
Yeah.
And maybe from there's another kind of superhuman or more evolved perspective, that that's our weakness, that we couldn't, you know, we couldn't act as if the future generation was right here, right now, making claims on us.
I wouldn't call this book sci-fi. If someone would, I also wouldn't argue. But is it the first book that you've written in the future? Set in the future?
Yeah, I think it is. Let me think about that. Yeah, no, definitely it is. And I wouldn't, you know, same thing. I wouldn't call it that. But I'm, you know, I love sci-fi. I've read a ton of it. It's what I grew up on. I'm, you know, if someone else wants to, I'm perfectly happy.
Yeah. I don't know what the difference is, but I think it somehow goes back to your point of you didn't use the opportunity of sci-fi to make as many changes, as many interesting changes as you could. You had this one premise and you stuck with it and you tried to be as faithful to what really would happen. But have you written as many really gripping action scenes ever before with violence and stakes like that?
I suppose it's less violent, but there are a few action scenes in the novel I wrote about growing up in Hong Kong, Fragrant Harbor. But I did want, you know, to go back to the point about, you know, walls not being metaphors, you know, the physical facts. I wanted some of the danger and violence that's implicit in this wall. You know, they spend 2 years on duty guarding it. And the thing about that is any given day is quite monotonous. You don't want anything to happen. But if anything does happen, it's immediately a matter of life and death.
Yes.
You know, and the violence is not metaphorical. It's completely real. You can die. You can lose your life.
And the prose gets tighter and straighter and more urgent. And did you read anyone to get into that mindset?
No, I mean, I've read lots of books like that. And I've always really loved writers who can convey physical action, by which I don't necessarily mean shooty shooty bang bang. I just mean, you know, actual things happening in the world and momentum. And of whom one of the great writers in the English language tradition is Robert Louis Stevenson, I think, who's a funny thing because the two people who like him are kids who like them as stories, and he's also a complete writer's writer. You know, it's very well, I've never met an adult fiction writer who doesn't deeply admire Stevenson, and the prose has this quality of absolute translucence. You know, you can see through it. It's like the sheet of glass that's so clean you walk into it because you don't see it.
I've heard a similar thing about Vonnegut, that like when you're a smart teenager you love him, and then somehow you get a little more sophisticated and you're told, oh, it's so easy to like Vonnegut. And then when you really understand, not that I've gotten there, but when a writer really understands what craftsmanship is, you realize Vonnegut's a genius.
And I'm having that with my son, actually. I've been having pressed Vonnegut on him, and he's just turned 21, and Slaughterhouse-Five was one of the first adult books he read that completely blew his mind. It's very interesting seeing writers who can do that. And it's interesting who stays fresh, you know, because you can look back at things and they have kind of, you know, things go off and date and go musty. And then there's other writing that, you know, has that mysterious power to just, it is the deep mystery about, you know, creative arts and writing at a very high level, is it's all about newness.
And I think my last question is, so I, because I've watched the whole series and read a few of the books, couldn't help but thinking of Game of Thrones here and there. But what about you? Have you watched that? Did you think of Game of Thrones when you put your character up on the wall, staring down and watching out for others slash wildings?
I'm a huge fan. I'm a series one, episode one fan of Game of Thrones, partly because I slightly know the then not famous, but now amazingly famous Richard Madden. He's a friend. He'd said he was in this thing that was coming up. And I think it was described by his agent as Sopranos meets Lord of the Rings. I remember immediately thinking, I'm going to love that. And I better watch it because, you know, they're only going to make three episodes. And actually, to be honest, that's still a slight mystery because I knew it's like they spent $100 million making something just for me. But it's still interesting that it's so caught on. Because out there in the world, plenty of people say, if you mention Tolkien or Lewis, people say, oh, I don't read fantasy. I mean, that's a massive, massive thing. And it's so interesting that he somehow... Martin's somehow been able to, or the showrunner's been able to break through that and get this gigantic global audience. So no, I am a massive fan. I didn't think of a direct link, but there is a kind of joint inspiration below it because Martin talked about Hadrian's Wall and, you know, my wall isn't 800 feet high and made of ice and magic spells. I don't want to disappoint prospective readers, but it is. It's made of concrete. It's 15 feet high. But I was rather inspired by Hadrian's Wall because as archaeologists find out more about it, we know about the people who are on it. And they're from far-flung bits of the Roman Empire. They're from, you know, modern-day equivalent of Syria, from modern-day equivalent of Belgium, modern-day equivalent of North Africa. And, you know, you wonder what it was like for them just literally standing on the edge of the world. That was the thing that I did have in my head, that feeling of really being on the edge of something, you know, basically wishing you were somewhere else.
The Wall, a new novel by John Lanchester. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And now, the spiel. The anteaters devoured the wildcats. World's wackiest nature documentary, I wish. It was actually a result, a surprise, in March Madness. But was it the biggest upset of March Madness so far? No. The biggest upset of March Madness happened today, and it was Donald Trump upsetting his Treasury Department. So the Treasury announced a new set of sanctions on North Korea, and then Donald Trump tweeted out, nah, I've canceled them. Wait, what? Sarah Huckabee Sanders clarifies, quote, President Trump likes Chairman Kim, and he doesn't think these sanctions will be necessary. What? You know that game, Pretty Kitty Kelly? It's like a logic puzzle, and you try to figure out the pattern. So it'll be like Pretty Kitty Kelly likes bees, but hates flies. Pretty Kitty Kelly likes apples, but hates pears. You try to figure it out from there, unless you know it already. You know, it's a pattern recognition game, and I'm always doing that with President Trump. Petty President Trump likes Kim, but hates McCain. Petty President Trump likes Kellyanne, but hates George. Petty President Trump likes Konstantin Kilimnik, but hates Michael Cohen. Do you get it? Is it that Trump likes K's? KKK's? No, it's not that, though. Might be, a little bit. Is it that he's a narcissistic madman with no rhyme or reason? Yes, exactly. And he is a madman, and this is, after all, March Madness. So maybe when you think about it, this whole backtracking, embarrassing the Treasury in public, maybe it wasn't that much of an upset. But this is the truly the biggest upset of March Madness. It is the totally unexpected, wacky addition to the Capital One commercials. You know the Capital One commercials, where those three besties, Samuel Jackson, Charles Barkley, and Spike Lee, engage in the tacit perpetuation of the myth that all black people in the entertainment industry know each other. Issa Rae, Dikembe Mutombo, Ja Rule, Cornel West, those guys have a summer share together. Well, that was the idea, and we got the idea. Sam and Spike, they kind of played versions of themselves in the pursuit of selling credit cards. Sam was skeptical. Spike was energetic but realistic. And then comes Charles. And Charles played like a 6'5" Ralph Wiggum.
Home, home on the range, where the deer and the cantaloupe play.
Stop, pump your brakes. Oh. Did you just say cantaloupe?
Yeah, makes sense.
How can it make sense?
Deer love cantaloupe.
Are you serious?
I don't think your melon is right.
Well, that was last year, and the years before that, and the year before that. Now, at different times, another member of the group was added. Alec Baldwin showed up for a little while. Gloria Gaynor sang a song. But now they have a whole new member of the crew. And it's a pretty big upset to me in March Madness that the fourth member of this crazy quartet is human normcore Jim Nantz.
What is this?
Behold, the final smorgasbord.
The final what is what?
On color commentary, it's me, Charles Broccoli. And we got the legendary Jim Nantz on the log.
Healthy and delicious.
And what Final Four is complete without my two buddies, Ham Jackson and Spike Bree? Yo, yo.
So what's going on in the commercial here is that Charles Barkley starts sprinkling some edible confection on his smorgasbord, and Jim Nantz, the CBS announcer, known mostly for golf and being boring, leans in to deliver his killer punchline.
And it's snowing in Minnesnackulous.
Blizzard-like conditions at the Final Four.
Oh, how Spike and Sam laughed and laughed at this Jim Nantz wisecrack. Set of words? Okay, it's that. I don't get it. Spike and Sam were once seen as dangerous and provocative and cool. They were definitely cool. And Charles, he really was dangerous. He once threw a guy through a plate glass window. But he was certainly a truth teller. Charles Barkley, man, he tells it like it is. Paired with Jim Nantz, and they find Jim Nantz delightful? He is the group's new cut-up? We're asked to imagine the off-the-wall conversations these four have about, I don't know, blazers and slacks and how Green Mile was an abomination. Oh, Nantz was on that. I would call Jim Nantz a straight arrow, but arrows sometimes have colorful feathers on them. Look, I know these commercials posit a fake world. Charles Barkley in real life, it's almost certain that the guy could tie his own shoes and that he's allowed to use forks without stoppers on them. But in the fake world, it should be heightened for humorous effect. The writers should come up with some great one-liners to make these three comic personalities shine. The put-downs should be vicious. And then enter Jim freaking Nantz, the kind of guy who bangs on your apartment door at 10:30 and tells you to turn down that Bill Haley and the Rockets LP. Jim Nantz guards the master ceremony like Cerebrus guards the underworld, only his three heads are soothing, calming, and deferential. Hello, friends. The fabled green jacket. Oh, an aggressive approach shot on 14. Sam, I have to say I loved it when you decried those motherfucking snakes on that motherfucking plane. Oh, how I and Brooks Koepka laughed. And Spike, you know, I always thought, to quote Brother Malcolm, we didn't land on Butler Cabin. Butler Cabin landed on us. This is the biggest upset of March Madness, by which I mean I'm upset. I always thought those Capital One commercials were lame, but at least they were consistent. They promoted a sport where the best players leave after 1 year, where teams switch conferences at the drop of an officially licensed hat. Against this backdrop, Chuck, Spike, and Sam were the most continuity March Madness had, and they go and bring in Beto O'Dork over here.
Darn you, Jim Nantz, with your rugged good looks and velvety voice.
Now that's the real voice of the Final Four.
Alas, it is. It is one of the biggest upsets of March Madness. But I console myself with this thought. So long as cuddly versions of once challenging artists and edgy athletes are used to sell credit cards, and so long as the TV network airing the finals charges an estimated $1.5 million for a single 30-second commercial, and so long as the actual players providing the entertainment don't see any of that money, well then I guess, when it's all said and done, the true meaning of March Madness stays intact, and I can't be very upset. And that's it for today's show. The Gist was produced by Pierre Bien-Aimé and Daniel Schrader. They are working on a novel that wonders what happens 50 years in the future when the president's sharpest top advisor is allowed to lay hands on a glowing orb and then Snapchat that to friends. The Sun is out in paperback, this never. TJ Raphael, senior producer of Slate Podcasts, she handed over the raw files of this week's Mom and Dad Are Fighting to the Attorney General, Barr, as per regulation. She can only wait and hope that he releases them in a timely manner and with proper compression. The Gist. Just think, from the time I record this to the time you hear it, we may find out that the P-tape was fake, that the P-tape was real, that the P-tape was a fake news hoax, or that the P-tape featured Devin Nunes' mom. Don't sue Devin. I didn't say it would happen. I just said it could. Oopru depru du peru. And thanks for listening.